It's Outdoor Explorer. I'm Charles Wolfworth. In the 2 days, 2 years we've been doing this show, we have run into some themes. And one of those themes is that Alaskans invent a lot of stuff to do what they want to do outdoors. On today's show, we're focusing closer on this fascinating topic with three guests who build their own gear. You can make your own skis, you can create new bikes, and innovate your own mountaineering gear. Lots of people do it. Gear is part of the fun for everyone, and when you come up with your own solutions, it's particularly rewarding. We'll talk about why you would want to make your own gear, how, and the benefits of the stuff Alaskans have invented. Some of which people use all the time now. Fat tire bikes, pack rafts, really fun stuff that needed to be invented, and now we've got it. And so in the studio with me, I have Dmitry Sidorov, who is came to Alaska from Russia 18 years ago, or rough, that's about right, hey, Dmitry. And he's a mountaineer and has made a lot of his own gear and knows how to do that. And Eric Parsons, who is the founder of Revelate Designs, which is an Anchorage-grown business that manufactures accessories for bikes, especially fat bikes. And later on, we're going to have a ski maker from Haynes, Ian Seward. He's going to join us later in the show. So, Eric, fat bikes themselves are kind of uniquely Alaskan things, although now they're spreading all over the country.
Yeah.
That just came into existence because people want to be able to bike on snow. And I think you got here today on your bike, right?
Right, yeah, I rode over here, yeah.
Yeah,
fat biking has really, really exploded. It's all over. There's articles in the paper about how much it's booming these days, just both in Alaska and lower 48. So, yeah, it's
caught a lot. And you figured out that there were some needs to carry stuff on the bike or what?
Yeah, it's kind of, I feel like there's two users in some extent. It's like there's people, you know, it's winter, and so you need to carry more stuff. You need to carry water. You need to carry extra gloves, down jacket. So it's like there's some stuff that we make that works well for that. And then, like, what I started the business doing was more for, like, this quote extreme user who's doing, you know, races on, you know, the Iditarod Trail or, like, the Sitna 100 and stuff like that, where you actually need to carry bivy gear to spend a night out. And, okay, how are you going to do that? How are you going to do it light? How are you going to do it so you can still push your bike and be comfortable? So, yeah, that's kind of how we started.
How did you get aware of the need? Were you doing these races yourself?
Yeah, it was. I think in 2005, so I moved up here in 2002 and then just kind of like got into this whole snow biking thing. It was really new to me and trying to figure out how to keep my feet warm and all that, which is a whole other story. But for carrying gear, exactly, I entered the Iditarod Trail Invitational in 2005, I think. And for that, I was like, okay, great. Now I need to like make all this stuff. I need to make pogies. I need to make, you know, need to just have some way to carry gear. And so that got the bells. I mean, the wheels turning. Uh-huh. You know, I already had from touring background. I already had some of that figured out. But it was really like, wow, this is like there's nothing out there to actually buy. Like everyone's cobbling stuff together for this. Like there's mm-hmm. nothing you can just go buy that would do any of this. Like for the most part. Yeah. So,
well, there's nobody else who's like trying to ride through the wilderness in the snow, right? I mean, it's like
right. Yeah, it's pretty niche. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So, but you are kind of a guy who likes making things anyway,
right? Yeah.
With the engineering background and you got into sewing and putting this stuff together and figuring it out. I feel like a lot of people who do backpacking or climbing, they really like to do that anyway. I mean, it's sort of the gear is part of the fun, and people in camp will be talking about it. How can they can make it better? It's always fun to show yours off. Is that part of where the impetus for this comes from?
A little bit. I think you can deny, but I think most people are gear freaks. Everyone likes to get new stuff and like gear nuts and having it be lighter and whatever. And it's like, I feel like there's two kinds. It's like, there's people that'll just keep buying whatever's new and those people have money, which is great. But, you know, not everybody has tons of money just to buy new stuff all the time. And then there's the kind that will take something and hack it to pieces and build it how they want it to be. And then they'll use it forever because it works for them, you know? So,
well, here, and we bring Dmitry into this conversation because I see he's nodding, but I think there's a third
he's
kind
one of them.
There's a third kind of gear freak, which is the kind of gear freak who wants to kind of look good because he's taken the cruddiest gear and he's like reworked it so that it works like as well or better than somebody else. And so then this is another claim to fame, right?
Pretty much. So, like, you buy a piece of gear and you wear it out, and as Eric said, you don't have money to go and buy every new piece of equipment. So you just start repairing and patching, and then you realize you can add something that actually would make piece work for you specifically in conditions or circumstances you have. So, and then it just contagious. So you just keep, you know, I can modify that and make it anything, coffee cones to tents, and, you know.
Yeah. Well, I have a friend who said he's the kind of person who would spend $20 worth of glue to fix a $10 part, right? That's like fixing it, having it be your own. It's part of it. So, I mean, Dimitri, you were saying you've made sleeping bags. You were showing me this garment that you made, which you could talk about later, which is pretty unique. And but you're coming from Russia. It sounds like a kind of a different... Mother's the necessity of invention, as they say over there.
I would agree. Yeah, definitely. So if you just, first of all, in the climbing community or outdoor community in Russia in those days, you just couldn't buy pretty much equipment like carabiners, ropes. Ropes were actually fishing lines, thick fishing lines. Wow. No dynamic ropes, all static. So to work with that equipment, you have to adopt and use proper belay techniques because rope doesn't stretch. So you can't just get the belay device, jam the rope there, and, you know, go on. You have to hold the rope in your hands and absorb the fall by just feeding the rope out until there is enough tension there that you can just actually squeeze the rope and stop it. So, as you said, invention is born out of necessity.
Sounds safe.
It sounds kind of Alaskan and hardcore though too, doesn't it? I mean, like, is it a large climbing community, or in those days in Russia were there a lot of people doing it, or is it just a tiny little sliver of people figuring out how to do these things?
Well, it used to be, I'd say, pretty small community. You know, we always would catch this looks from outsiders, like, are you guys being paid for climbing up? And we would say, oh yeah, like ruble emitter. And people would take it seriously sometimes, but it was kind of unconventional way of spending time and very limited resources. And nowadays it's a you know, free market economy,
right,
as much as it can be. So people have resources and they spend money, and then there is growing community, of course. And some real serious adventurers came from Soviet Union, former Soviet Union, and from Russia, like bikers, boulders, sailors.
People who are very tough. So what part of the country were you living in, and did you do your outdoor stuff?
Well, I grew up in St. Petersburg. It's the second largest city in Russia. And... well, there is no mountains around, just lakes and kind of forest and some bluffs for rock climbing. But my parents were climbing instructors.
Oh, really?
Yeah, in addition to their regular, you know, annual jobs, engineers, they were, they would take time off in the summer and go to climbing ranges like Caucasus or Pamirs and teach climbing courses. And that's where everything started for me.
So, Eric, how did you originally get into what you do? I mean, in terms of like developing your interest in mountain biking and then coming to Alaska, I guess.
Right. Yeah. The long backstory. Let's see. So I grew up in New York, and I think pretty influential for me was just my upbringing. We were really outdoor, really active in the outdoors, hiking, and mostly just hiking. And then somewhere, I guess, in my, like when I was like 8 or 9, my family started doing these long summer-long road trips where we would just drive across country or fly to like a major airport on the West Coast somewhere and spend 2 months just car camping and backpacking. And you know, I was pretty young. I was like 8 or 9, not super young, but, and that kind of instilled this like, oh yeah, this is, yeah, there's bigger mountains out there than New York has. And made me, you know, that was a pretty lasting impression of some of those trips. And so new and, once it was like, okay, time to go to college, all this. It's like, I knew I wanted to get west. And so I ended up, let's see, went to school in Colorado, then graduated from there, and then eventually, you know, I just kind of got sick of the crowds, and I heard good news about Alaska, and basically, you know, literally, I was like, from like one or two people, they were like, yeah, Anchorage is pretty cool, and you know, I was working as an engineer at the time, and then they were like, yeah, there's pretty cool stuff going on up there, and
You're at the age where you go wherever you want.
Yeah, yeah. That sounded better than like designing culverts, like the Colorado, like urban sprawl. Yeah. Range. So I just basically just drove up sight unseen, and that's, you know, I'm sure it's similar to a lot of people's stories.
Fell in with a group of people who were doing some of these extreme races.
Yeah, fell into a really great group of friends who I'm still like pretty tight with today, and right away it was awesome. Went for a bike ride on a Klutna Lake and like literally met people that I'm still really good friends with today out of that. And I felt, I was like, okay, this is good.
Yeah.
I'm gonna stick around for a while.
Yeah. So you're around biking from the beginning, huh?
Yeah. I mean, I started.
Cause I mean, you're around biking. I grew up in Anchorage and it didn't used to be a thing. You know, there was no such thing as year round biking. And it sort of like has come up and become huge. Mm-hmm. I mean, people are biking all over Anchorage all winter long.
Yeah. And I knew like I said, I started mountain biking. I think I saw a mountain bike on a trip through British Columbia with my family when I was, you know, 10 or something. And I was like, that's cool. And it was just in the budding phases of mountain biking. And I knew I wanted to get that. So I got, you know, I got a real mountain bike with actual gears when I was like 13 or something. Yeah. And then I just like, that was my passion through, you know, high school and just all my life really. So, yeah, but when I moved up here, I was like, okay, this whole winter thing, Alaska, this is like uncharted territory completely. I have no idea what I'm getting myself into. And
yeah,
had to learn a lot. Yeah.
So as you have, come through this, then you've turned it into your entire livelihood now.
Right. Yeah.
And you own a business manufacturing stuff.
Yeah. And for me, it's pretty cool.
Which Dimitri's never going to buy because he makes everything himself.
I know. That's fine.
No, I may. Well, why not?
Yeah. For me, it's more like, okay, I've had this lifelong passion for mountain biking and cycling, and it's like, so I kind of view it as more of that. It's like I've been able to tie in this kind of thing that goes back 20 years now to what I'm doing like professionally, as you know, and for an income. So that's pretty rewarding. Yeah.
So when you look at how these fat tire bikes got invented, it was sort of like people were doing the race and somebody figured out, well, let's just take two rims and put them together. Then I'm going to float on top of the snow better. And then somebody else figured out, well, we could improve upon that. And then it was a while before it got to where it was an actual manufactured product, you know? I mean, Dimitri, when you have built stuff, do you find like you make the first one and it kind of works and then you get rid of that because you want to make a better one and sort of this process of improvement? Or do you make everything perfect the first time?
No, well, I wish I could. But actually, part of making things and taking it to a test and then figuring out the weaknesses and then bringing it back, it's part of the fun part. You know, I wouldn't want to make a perfect thing. I think it would take away a lot of what we actually get back from doing the things.
Constant improvement.
Yeah, yeah. So you have an idea. You see somebody's doing something and it's like, oh, how about this? And there is this uncharted little path of the entire huge world. It's like, oh, what if I, you know, chart it a little bit, and then it keeps that energy up, and you keep, you know, feeding it and making things.
Especially in a world where you have to make everything. I mean, like you're talking about starting out in Russia, where you're sort of required to make all of your gear. It's not optional.
Yeah, pretty much. Or you use something that is really, I don't know, military or heavy or unusable.
yeah. So what percentage of what you use now is stuff that you make? I mean, do you still make a lot of stuff?
No, I think right now I would opt for finding things and buying them. What do I make now? Well, I'm making change my kind of direction a little bit. I like to brew beer and make sauerkraut and make bread. So it's a little bit different, but still the same kind of set of skills.
Yeah. Well, one of the things that's true here in Anchorage is that you can buy incredible stuff. I mean, people are manufacturing stuff to very, very tiny little niches in the market. You know, if you want shoes with metal studs on them, you can go down to Skinny Reven and have your selection of them. If you want whatever it is you want, somebody's making it out there. For you might have to pay quite a bit, but No, actually, the whole fat tire bike thing, my only complaint about it is that these bikes are still so expensive.
Yeah, and it's funny because like as the, it's, you know, it's like as innovation on that's grown, it's like people are like, well, I don't want just this cheap one. You know, everyone's starting to like equate it to like, you know, modern bikes, which are expensive and light and fast and everything mm-hmm. else. And it's like, you know, that's really obviously taken off like the last few years, because it's like, okay, everyone's like, okay, we got this figured out, we got fat bikes and rims and tires available. And then it's like now they're all the major brands are going to town on like just making everything racy and light,
carbon and yeah, and thing. And
beautiful,
yeah.
Specializing basically yeah, yeah, in, exactly. in various dimensions.
Yeah, and that's, you know, it's the same way with what we do. It's like, you know, we start and we're making some fundamental bags. And then you just keep refining them and refining yeah. and refining them and make some different ones. And
well, I was yeah. going to ask about that. Dimitri was talking about like you make something, you try it out, you find out, oh, it could be better. Yeah. Is that sort of the process you went in when you were starting your products?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, before I started making bike bags, I was making whatever I wanted to for myself. You know, I'd make backpacks. I made, you know, climbing bibs and stuff like that. And that was fun because I didn't really care what it looked like. I wasn't going to sell it. It was just for me. And mm-hmm. in most part, it was like, okay, I can make it the way I wanted to. But yeah, now it's, you know, that's like the fun part of the job is like having new ideas, actually sketching them out. And then for me, it's like I spend a ton of time just internally in my head putting those pieces together, like way before I even like sit down in front of a sewing machine or cut fabric. It's like usually before I even start doing that, I have a pretty good idea how it's all going together. And so... I think, and it's because like my skills is like building soft goods. As that's gotten better, it's like I don't need to figure out how every seam's gonna lay out. I kind of got that, and it's like now it's like more like big picture, mm-hmm. how it's actually gonna function. Yeah,
yeah, the weight and why somebody would want to buy it, I suppose.
Yeah, and that's become a little bit more of an issue as our business has grown. It's like, you know, we could usually like when I started, it was like okay, I was making stuff out of my garage. People were just buying it directly from me. I could kind of sell prototypes and like get feedback from them and kind of be like, all right, I think this is working, you know, and that was great. You know, it was really good, but I can't do that anymore. He's like, if I do that, it's like, we're making lots of them. And then we're gonna have like, you know, I can't use my customers as like testers really anymore. Cause it's like, you know, it's gotta be right from the get go. Yeah.
So your business Revelate Designs mm-hmm. is now, you've got employees, you've got a production facility, marketing, distribution. I mean, it doesn't sound that much fun anymore, right?
Yeah, it's been a lot of growing pains in the last uh-huh. few years for sure. And yeah, like kind of that stuff you're just saying, it's like a lot of that's taken a huge chunk of my time, you know, whereas it used to be like, okay, I could spend 80% of my time sewing and designing stuff and then 20% figuring out how to run this business. Mm-hmm. And now it's like it turned into this beast where it's like I'm spending 80% of my time running the business and answering emails and like very little time. And, you know, earlier this summer was really busy for us and I basically got no sewing this time. So yeah, that's been a big growing pain
yeah,
for sure.
But you get to have a business doing what you enjoy doing. So there's yeah, nothing wrong with that.
Yeah. And it's like figuring it out, you know, finding, you know, the right people to help with things. And that's, you know, mm-hmm. it's all part of it.
So do you have like professional athletes that model and test gear?
I was gonna check in with you, Dimitri, actually, yeah. I need a professional unicycler.
Sure, yeah. Sounds great. I rode here on my unicycle.
Oh my gosh, I didn't see it there yeah. in the corner.
It's right there.
Well, yeah, it's funny.
So I've heard of fat tire biking, but I had not heard about wintertime unicycling. That's mm-hmm. Okay, that's taking it to a new level.
Well, I have to fatten it a little bit. It's still pretty sleek.
Do you have studs on that thing?
No.
He's daring. I hope you didn't have to go too far.
No, just, yeah, close.
Okay.
Actually, yeah, somebody I think has done the White Mountains on a White Mountains 100 on a unicycle. Seriously? I know someone's done... like this is at 100.
There was yeah. a...
I keep hearing about crazy stuff that I can't believe yeah. during this show.
That's I mean, it's really easy to walk with it. You just jump off and start walking.
Right. So. Yeah, that's right.
There was a Fireweed 400 division, I think, this year. Or maybe one person rode for like 20 miles or something.
Oh, my God.
Not the entire 400.
That doesn't sound very comfortable. Right. It's Outdoor Explorer. I'm Charles Wolforth, and we're chatting about making your own gear, building equipment to use outdoors. And in the studio with me are Dimitri Sidorov, who is just a gear innovator and a unicyclist, has many other claims to fame, and Eric Parsons, who's the founder of Revelate Designs, manufacturing accessories for bikes. And We're going to be back with both of these guys and with another guest. And we're going to get into talking about some actual products and inventions and sharing some of our ideas. And so maybe you'll hear some stuff that you'd like to try to build. But first, we're going to take a quick break. Will Spears is a dedicated ski bum. He hails from Girdwood. And when he's not out on the mountain, you'll probably find him in his shop building skis. With his girlfriend, Janine Armour, Spears founded Chugach Snow Tools. Our Indy, Alaska video team recorded this package with them last winter.
I guess when I first started trying to do it, I wanted to build skis for myself. And then the first pair I skied on, I was so nervous riding up the lift. You know, I didn't want the ski to explode or break or the bindings to rip out. I was definitely very nervous skiing them for the first time. I've been skiing since I was a little kid, 3 or 4 years old, and grew up skiing in North Carolina. My parents would take us up to the mountains quite often to ride the ice hills there. When I was 18, I decided that I wanted to be a ski bum or work in the ski industry, and I have been just skiing and working on skis ever since. Chugach Snow Tools was founded September of 2012. I think people like my skis because they're unique and they are handmade right here in Girdwood. So it's something that's it's different.
We met at Alaska Resort. He was the ski tuner there, and I worked upstairs in the rental shop. He was kind of the typical, you know, ski town ski bum, working on skis and partying and skiing. And he had told me about his ideas, and looking beyond the drunken ski bum days, I could kind of see that, you know, deep down there was a potential and a passion for sure.
Well, I actually built a ski with just clamps, just trying to do it probably 10 years ago, just to see if I could do it out of old materials that I just found laying around. And that didn't work out at all. I've just always had a passion for making things and always liked working on skis. So it was just, felt like it just kind of happened naturally. Building the first pair of skis was definitely very stressful. I didn't realize how much went into it. And you know, you read all the little steps that it takes, and then actually doing them is a whole nother ball game. It's just really amazing when you can see a board and a roll of fiberglass and a roll of plastic and a gallon of glue turn into something that you can go out and have a lot of fun on.
Oh my God, there's tons of challenges. Our ski press itself is made out of I-beams. It weighs over a ton. We've had to move it 3 times. You know, not coming from money. We're earning it. We're earning every penny that we make from this.
That is the eventual goal, is to make a living. I've had tremendous support from a lot of folks, and business is going good and going as planned. It's kept me out of the bars a lot, which is a good thing. It's put my focus and money towards something that's a lot more constructive.
I mean, he still drinks beers, he still goes out and skis, he still has fun, he loves his job. He just kind of grew up a bit, I would say, from the guy I started dating.
I think Alaska is different in a lot of ways. We are separated from the rest of America, and we tend to like to support each other. It's having pride in your peers and wanting everyone, wanting your neighbors to succeed. You always hear people here saying living the dream, and it sounds a little cliche, but it's kind of the truth. Everyone here is living their dream, and I do feel like I'm living my dream.
We're back. I'm your host, Charles Wolforth. It's Outdoor Explorer. And today we're talking about making your own equipment, making outdoor equipment. And in the studio, we have Eric Parsons from Revelate Designs, who makes adventure biking accessories, and Dmitry Sidorov, an innovative mountaineer here in Anchorage, originally from Russia. And now welcoming to the show, Ian Seward from Fairweather Ski Works in Haines, joining us by phone. Hi, Ian.
Hi there. It was great to join you, albeit a little bit late.
No problem at all. So tell us about what you do at Fairweather Ski Works.
Well, we're in our second season right now, and we're just building handcrafted wooden skis using, you know, as much local wood resource as possible. And, you know, it's been a long time dream, and we're kind of, you know, coming along with it now. We've got worked out a lot of the kinks in our system, and we're figuring out how to get these skis out to the people, and they seem to be really well received right now.
Wow. So I grew up on wooden skis, and I still have one of the pairs that I have not skied on in decades and decades. But they were all replaced with, synthetic materials a long time ago. Why go back to wood?
Well, it's interesting. Our skis have the appearance of one of those older style of wooden skis, but we're actually using all the same modern materials as any of the other ski companies that way. We use fiberglass reinforcement and carbon fiber when it's called for, metal edges and P-TEX bases and so forth. But, the appearance of our skis is one of the things that really grabs people right away, and it's kind of one of our differentiating points from other ski companies, is that we use wood veneers for the visible, top sheet layer right there.
Oh,
and,
wow.
We have everything from domestic woods to various exotic woods. But, our favorite and the most popular among our customers is a local spalted birch in the Chilkat Valley, and those are just stunning.
That sounds great. That sounds like it would be really popular.
Well, they seem to be taking off well for us. We're pleased with the success that we've met so far. Like I said, we're only in our second season, but it seems to be going well. And we're just finding new ways to reach out to people and kind of become known and get these on as many people's feet as we possibly can right now.
Uh-huh. So how did you get into this? How did you get into doing this? What was it? Because, we don't think of Haines as being like the center of manufacturing. You know, it's like, you might think that maybe China would be where, or maybe for skis, maybe Switzerland or something. But Haines wouldn't be the first place I'd think of.
Well, Haines, the beauty of Haines is that it's really visible in the media nowadays as a world-class destination for big mountain skiers. And so, I've been thinking for years myself about, how could we, take advantage of that situation in this little kind of niche in time right now to start making skis, because it just seemed like you couldn't fail with it if we went for it. And I've been kind of mulling that over for a couple of years, but unable to take a break from my regular woodworking practice to kind of start something new. And about 2 years ago, I just had the great fortune of picking up my business partner and his wife hitchhiking out in my neighborhood there, which is a really quiet end-of-the-road place. So it was a bit surprising, and I grabbed these guys, and in no time flat, we had found a common interest in skis and ski building, and I think it's about a 15-minute drive to town from where I'm at. And in that time, we had pretty much hatched a plan to start this whole business. He'd already been building skis, for himself for a number of years, originally as a kind of more of a hobby sort of thing, and then had started just a very small company of his own. But with my shop resources and background in fine woodworking, we were able to kind of put our experience together to come up with something better than we each could have done individually.
I would think it would be difficult to make skis. I mean, it was quite a learning process to be able to come up with a product that was really, really superior.
Yeah, it's an ongoing learning process, I've discovered. And gratefully, my partner went through most of the mistakes on his own before we even met. And, there were just endless pitfalls and trial and error to go through to come up with a successful product. And like I said, he took care of most of that before we met. But as we've, scaled up production and started adapting, different materials and different processes, we've had, a bit of a learning curve, yeah. But we've eventually come up with something that we can produce really reliably now, and be able to just put a reliable, consistent ski out there on the market that people love to ski. They've got a great feel, and we kind of are geared toward backcountry use more than the ski resorts. But we have skis designed for every purpose and every person's need.
Wow! So how many people are there building these skis now? Is it still kind of a handcraft thing, or are you getting it into a larger kind of production line?
No, we're still pretty small right now. Basically, it's just my partner, Graham Kraft, and I, and the two of us work on it, and we recruit some occasional help from friends. You know, one of the ways we got the business started was to hold a workshop, a ski building workshop in the community, wherein, you know, anyone who wanted to in town could come and, you know, for a certain fee, come there and build their own skis and learn the process. And so we use that seed money to kind of build some of the tools. We have a pneumatic press that we built ourselves out of wood. It might be one of the only wooden ones out there. But, yeah, that's kind of how we got started.
Wow. So let me turn to my other guest in the studio here, Eric Parsons, who's mm-hmm. got something of a similar story in coming up with his own products for fat tire bikes and now just for bikes in general. Eric, mm-hmm. how did you get from sort of messing around into, like, we're hearing from Ian, into sort of producing a consistent product that could come out the same every time and making it, you know, be what people really wanted? Mm-hmm.
Let's see.
Was that a big challenge?
A very big challenge. for me, it was like, you know, I was all self-taught with how to sew stuff. And I could get ideas and I could make stuff, but the whole idea of production sewing and manufacturing, as far as that goes, was completely out of my ball game. Like, I had no idea what I was doing. Like, I was faking it, but it was not faking it, but I mean, I was doing the best I could. But I mean, I was doing it totally wrong and spending six times as much time as it should have been. So, the breaking point happened where I found, you know, now we have a big, you know, we have a shop in Anchorage where we're making stuff, but we have a partner in Oregon who's doing the bulk of our production now. And it was mostly like, you know, making that contact. And originally, like, they were just making a few things for us. Like, we started really small, but just talking to him and like visiting and just immersing myself, because they have, you know, him and his wife have, like, you know, 30 something combined years of experience doing this. So just like seeing what they were doing is like, oh yeah, that's how you're actually supposed to make patterns. And that's why this isn't lining up. And just, you know,
oh, wow.
Like really seeing like, okay, yeah, there's like a whole art form to this. And it's,
but what was the first thing that you, when you were biking and you figured out this is a product that needs to exist and I can come up with it. What was sort of the innovation, your first sort of light bulb that went off?
Well, it was the need for frame bags. You know, it's basically the bag that goes in the middle of the bike frame, and there really wasn't much out there at all. There's
a lot of wasted space there where you could carry something.
Yeah, I mean, there was a guy making them, but their quality wasn't good, and there wasn't much availability. It was like, okay, you get this Cordura bag with some Velcro, and it just wasn't really a good. I don't know. It got the job done, but I was like, oh, I can make better bags than that. You know. Mm-hmm. And so I was like, okay, modern materials, we'll use like, you know, fancy fabrics and, you know, water resistant zippers and all this stuff. And so that was like my mainstay of like what I was doing for a while. Yeah.
Uh-huh. Mm-hmm. So Dimitri, so we've got a guy who's making wood laminate skis and Hanes, and mm-hmm. and Eric is making these frame bags with and then you were showing me a shirt that you made. Uh-huh. It looks unlike any other shirt I've seen.
Oh, good.
To tell folks about what that is.
That's the first thing people usually say.
Yeah. it's like you're using fleece, but it's more like a net material.
Right. Well, the closest thing I can think of to compare it would be a mosquito mesh or mosquito net in a way, like thick, ropey thing that, you know, people that travel in tropical countries would put either between layers of clothes or next to the skin, that mosquito basically can't reach you physically with the proboscis. Uh-huh. So, well, the idea of using that in while climbing or in cold climates is that sort of mesh traps air, and air is a very good insulator. So you kind of want to buff up that buffer between you, your skin, and the environment, so you can wear bulky clothes. Down equipment is good, but if it gets wet, it's pretty much useless. And if you work hard physically, use, you know, like sweat or just rolling in the snow, you know, equipment gets wet, so you get cold. Down doesn't work if it's wet. So this idea of mesh being worn right next to your skin, so it traps air, creates this insulation, and also is a you know, side effect of that. The contact of fabric with your skin is limited because most of that is a cell of the hair, and just the connections are pretty small. So it seems like you would cool less due to conduction and heating up your
sweat. I think you should describe it a little better, because when I'm thinking of mesh, I think of literally like mosquito mesh. Like what you've got is like a real open, there's like more, gladiators sort yeah. of met, you know?
Yeah.
There's more air than fleece there.
Yeah, it's like...
More air than fleece, for sure. Yeah. And the cells are probably inch by on inch, yeah, and the fleece parts maybe like quarter inch, and it's all so sewn together.
So like where did you get the idea for this?
Well, when I was living in Russia, still my mom crocheted me a similar garment from wool, from yarn, and it eventually worn out. So, I wouldn't muscle crocheting that stuff. So I said, how can I hack something similar in a matter of a couple hours? And I said, oh, how about this? And just lay the t-shirt, put the pieces together, and wood glue them first, and then put the sewing machine through it in the evening. After, you know, a couple hours, I had the thing.
It had it, and you believe it works better than just wearing if it was solid fleece.
Well, actually, I worked at Ski Patrol at that time, so next morning I took it to test. It turned out to be too warm because, in Washington it wasn't that cold, but here in Alaska in the winter with Denali, it works fine.
So would that be a traditional thing that people would wear in Russia, sort of a crocheted wool sort of mesh undershirt? Because that doesn't sound anything I'm familiar with in this country. I mean, people wear long underwear, but I don't think of like a crocheted heavy wool thing next to your skin.
No, it's not traditional at all. It just really was invented by a group of climbers that started going climbing in the winter. That's the only thing.
And they said, hey, this works.
Yeah. You couldn't even go if you didn't have one, so they wouldn't take you. So I had to make one if I wanted to go.
So I had I want to share my invention. I'm nowhere up with these guys, but we're gonna have a break. And before we do, I'm gonna tell you about my invention. And then when we come back from the break, we're gonna learn more about building skis in Haines and building bike gear and miscellany here in Anchorage. So I found that with my boat, we enjoyed going camping in Prince William Sound, Ketchumak Bay, and I did not want to carry a dinghy on the boat to get ashore, adding weight. So I would set up a running line, which is a pulley system that would go from an anchor that I would put out in the water off the beach, and then another anchor on shore, and you could pull the boat in and out. But the first couple of seasons, I found out my lines were constantly getting tangled, and it would take forever to reel them in and get the lines put away so they wouldn't get tangled. So I decided to make a bag that would hold the two lines, and then would be fastened through the bottom of the bag, and so that I could just back out and the line would run out. And then when I was coming in, I could get two people to just stuff the line back in the bag, Velcro it shut, and it wouldn't be tangled. It worked beautifully. And so I got somebody to manufacture this for me, only one copy, which is the only copy that exists in the world, I think. And we're going to hear about that company right now. It's Nomar Manufacturing in Homer, which was named the Alaska Manufacturer of the Year by the Made in Alaska organization. And the company's been churning out gear for fishermen, hunters, oilmen, and outdoor enthusiasts for more than 35 years. Using some remarkable materials. And as I said, they've made stuff for me. It's a really neat business, and we have this report about it from Aaron Selbig in Homer.
Are you must be Kate?
I'm Kate.
Kate Mitchell is co-owner of Nomar. Now tell the truth, when you think of Nomar, what do you think of? Probably a big retail store, right?
It's true. It's what most people think Nomar is. The jackets, the fleece jackets, bags. Evolved from, hey, people need this stuff. So everything you see that Nomar makes is an idea that a local or Alaskan came and said, hey, I need this. And we made a prototype. We took care of that customer. But if it was something that was good for everybody who lives in Alaska, pretty soon it was on the shelf.
Nomar does carry products from other manufacturers. Things like smart wool socks and MSR camping gear. but the vast majority of the stuff for sale is made on site. The shop carries heavy-duty gear bags, specially designed for workers on the North Slope, jackets and vests made just for commercial fishermen, and even a waterproof shotgun scabbard inspired by duck hunters at the head of Ketchumack Bay. The heart of Nomar lies beyond the retail store, in the back where an enormous manufacturing plant takes up most of the building. Employees here are hard at work, stitching, sewing, and cutting a wide variety of products. The company's bread and butter product is probably the Brailler bag, an innovative idea that began in the early 1980s when a couple of Bristol Bay fishermen complained to Kate Mitchell that the nets they were using to deliver product to the processors were making marks on the fish.
They were marked with that webbing, that net, and the processors were giving them a reduced price for every one of those fish. So it started off pure dollars and cents. We need something that doesn't mark the fish, and yet we can quickly deliver a load of product.
The mesh bags are built tough and built to last. They come in various sizes, some of them capable of holding more than 2,000 pounds of fish, and each one has a set of loops on the top that allow it to be picked up by a crane. The name Nomar, in fact, sprang from the Brailler bag, which leaves no marks, Nomar, on the fish. The bag was an instant hit and took Nomar in an entirely new direction, from a boat top shop to a full-fledged manufacturing plant. Kelly Summers is busy putting together a Brailler bag in anticipation of the upcoming fishing season.
It's got several layers of sewing on these seams because that picture, I love that picture. I keep that by the machine so that it reminds me how many pounds of fish those guys are around. You don't want anything busting on them and you don't want the handles breaking on them. So he gets two entire layers of super thick thread. I mean, we could make something for you out of this, and you could you could walk on this, couldn't you? This, it doesn't break. He gets a lot of stitches.
Summers is an experienced seamstress who has been here at Nomar for the last 4 years. She's one of 15 local workers who are employed here year-round.
There are those businesses that hire in the spring and then lay off, and I was raised in a family that, you know, you work for somebody, you work for them year-round, and we've developed this business to be a year-round permanent.
Despite its massive 7,500-square-foot presence on Pioneer Avenue downtown, Nomar sprang from the humblest of beginnings.
Business started in a 1952 GMC school bus. Because in those days, we were Coast Guard, we were new to town. I knew we wanted a sewing business, and no one had a space that they would rent to a transit, you know, person.
That town was Ketchikan, and the year was 1976. 2 years later, Kate's husband, Ben, was transferred to the Cutter Hickory, and the family, along with their business, resettled in Homer. After a while, it was time to move on to bigger and better things, so the school bus became a dirt floor Quonset hut, and then the dirt floor Quonset hut became the state-of-the-art facility you see today.
In the end, we ended up with 7,500 square feet of building with concrete floor, two bathrooms, because out on Ketchumack Drive, we had an outhouse, and so this was going uptown.
Big time.
Big time. Big time.
Reporting from Homer, I'm Aaron Selvig.
You're listening to Outdoor Explorer on KSKA Anchorage. The program repeats tonight at 9 o'clock on FM 91.1. Connect with Outdoor Explorer anytime. Download podcasts and see what's coming up on future programs by going to our website at alaskapublic.org.
We'll be right back.
We're back. You're listening to Outdoor Explorer. I'm Charles Wolforth. Today we're talking about making your own equipment. And we've got some amazing guys here who do just that. Eric Parsons of Revelate Designs makes adventure biking accessories. Dmitry Sidorov, an innovative mountaineer here in Anchorage who has brought all these ideas from Russia. And Ian Seward from the Fairweather Ski Works in Haines, who for the past couple of years has been building skis. And these are high-end skis that have wooden veneers made from local wood that sound just beautiful. And I'm just interested, Ian, in your market, who you're selling these skis to, because I imagine there's a lot of labor in every ski, and you can't be undercutting the competition. You must be selling to the really serious skier who are looking for the best possible equipment. Is that right?
Yeah, I think it kind of is, you know. Our kind of skis occupy an unusual niche in the ski world. And so, you know, folks who want that sort of thing are seeking them out. And, you know, they just want something, a change from the factory-made, garish, loud-colored sort of skis that we're all so used to. And so we've been reaching out initially through Facebook, you know, and that was a good way to get a start and word of mouth. But we finally got our website up and running. And on the website, a person can actually build their own ski and have a picture of it appear right beside the menu there. And they can choose what wood veneer they want. And, you know, we employ a lot of local artists, graphics and whatnot. And so they can choose art from a local artist and add it on there and have a picture of their ski actually appear beside it. And so we're hoping to reach a lot more people with that. And, wow. You know, as well, we've had a good stroke of fortune with having a customer down in California who we wholesale to, and he's selling quite a few out of his shop down in near Mount Whitney, and that's been a big boost to us as well.
Do you have any trouble keeping up?
To reach out and connect with people.
Is there any challenge of just keeping up with the amount of orders you have when you're just kind of a two-man operation?
Well, you know, it comes and goes, and there are definitely times when we get a little bit backed up and we really have to kind of crank to get everything out in a timely fashion. But, you know, we're hoping that kind of level of demand will stay high so we can actually hire some employees and give them some reliable work, which is one big goal of ours right now.
Yeah. Yeah. So I would think, I mean, I think it's a brilliant niche, really, because a lot of people who love skiing, especially backcountry skiing, are nature lovers and probably in the rest of their life don't go in for garish, bright-colored plastic stuff, right? And yet when you go to the ski
exactly.
shop, right, that's what everything looks like.
Mm-hmm, exactly. And I think we're really kind of fulfilling a need that's been out there for a long time and folks haven't been able to find. And there's a couple other companies doing this out there, and it's great to see that movement. You know, this kind of micro ski building industry has followed much the same trajectory as the micro brew industry has, where it's a small percentage of the overall, you know, beer market, but it's, within itself is wildly successful. And, you know, we've seen a lot of that in Colorado, where there's over two dozen small ski and, you know, builders like this. And now there's at least the three of us up in Alaska doing it. And it's just, you know, I think all of us doing it kind of just brings more attention to this kind of a product. And it's good for all of us.
That's a really good point. We were just talking in the studio about sort of the danger to small Alaska manufacturers of having your market eaten up by some big outside company that produces in China or something. And I know that mm-hmm. Bike manufacturers are now producing fat tire bikes elsewhere. But that doesn't happen to the microbreweries, because when you want a microbrew, you want a microbrew. You're not like Budweiser's not going to come in and take that market, right? And so that's sort of what you're after.
Yeah. Well, there's, you know, growing awareness among consumers for all sorts of things, be it beer or skis or whatever. They want something that's, you know, locally made and preferably using local materials, and that's got a lot of additional value to them. And so that's, you know, that's kind of the need that we're trying to fulfill with our business here.
Yeah, it's kind of bringing it back to a personal level. And I was talking about mm-hmm. that with Dmitry a little bit earlier about how he would use some of his, tell us this, the listeners, about a story about how you would use your Russian equipment to sort of buy Western equipment, sort of this like barter arrangement, like sort of like, again, sort of the one person to one person deal.
Well, once you figure out something and in the behind the iron curtain, you know, we didn't have a lot of, you know, international equipment or real equipment. So we would commission mechanics, somehow coax them into making something industrially, like ice screws. And it's a famous, very, very well known among climbers piece of item. Infamous Russian ice screws that are very cheap, made of titanium, used on atomic submarines, stolen from maybe one or some of them.
Oh, you're kidding. So, somebody who was working in a machine shop is making pieces of submarines. And
right here. So, I have two of these ice screws, and I brought one for Eric, one for Charles. So, you would find somebody, talk to them, and give them, I don't know if I can say it on air, like a bottle of vodka too. Uh-huh. And they would cut you these pieces, you know, overnight.
Okay.
And then you go to meet in foreign climbers and you trade that stuff for whatever you want or whatever they want.
Because the foreign climbers, it's the most exotic souvenir they could possibly have.
And like plastic boots was such a desirable item those days. I got my first pair of Asala. Black, yellow plastic boots for 20 this ice screws, and I just want to give you guys one of them.
So that's like a bottle of vodka for some ice screws, and then trade those to the
pretty prince. Much. Yeah.
Wow, these are pretty nice, though. Yeah.
Did this come from a submarine then?
I don't know.
Wow, so it's
but it's a titanium thing, mm-hmm. So it's like
it seems like
super
holds body weight.
Yeah,
it seems like it's pretty nicely made.
Yeah,
too.
It's an industrial standard. So.
Nice. Oh, thank you. Mm-hmm. Do I now owe you like a little bottle of vodka?
Nah, not at all. Enjoy. Hang it on the wall. Yeah. Have good memories.
But I mean, that's sort of like, again, we were talking about why you'd want to make your own gear. It kind of like makes it more fun when you're bartering and trading back and forth with people and mm-hmm. you know the people who made your gear. I mean, there's some folks up in Fairbanks that are making good gear, making tents, making apocalypse design, making clothing. Mm-hmm. Everybody knows who they are. So it's kind of like the community farm thing a little bit, isn't it? And do you feel that way at all about your business, Eric?
Yeah, because just the bike industry is pretty much like that. Everyone, you know, there's like mutual trades going on. So I get asked a lot of times, like, hey, I work for, you know, a brake company. Do you need brakes? I'll trade you some bags, you know, and it's great. And sometimes I'm like, I don't need a pair of triathlon road wheels, but you can pay me for my bag. You know? But yeah, it's fun. Sometimes it works out great because you're like, yeah, I really totally trade you some bags for some sweet hubs or something. Yeah.
Do you ever get ideas that come in from other athletes saying, you know, well, why didn't you ever make this or what, you know?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, this is kind of what I'm thinking about all the time. So it's like, usually I'm like, yeah, you know, I kind of have my own little priority list. You know, I've kind of working with like a bunch of people for quite a while who started off as customers. Now they're more like, you know, the term ambassador is overused, but that's kind of what they are. You know, they're not sponsored, but it's like you're part of the, you know, my people. they're
as Nike is to Michael Jordan, these people are to you, right?
I don't know. I think Nike pays Michael Jordan.
Oh, okay.
I don't pay these people anything. But no, it's just like they're friends, you know, they're uh-huh. friends. And it's like, hey, I need to, you know, what do you think of this? And, you know, here's a prototype. Go beat it up and see what happens.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Dimitri, are you still coming up with ideas and do you still have stuff that you make, or are you kind of moved beyond that stage of your life?
Well, you know, in general, I really like ideas and uh-huh. like from whatever area of life or not life, it's really hard to come up with new ideas. There is a lot of creative people that, as Eric said, they're thinking a lot and all the time about how to do things, what to do, what new and fun can be done. So I think good ideas are golden, and good ideas are that are in the hands of like outdoor fanatics, of people that want to go to, you know, long length to actually implement that, build something with their own hands, and use it later and give it to friends. It's do I come with ideas? I can't just say on the spot, but I'm like Eric. I think a lot about things, what, you know, around the house, innovations, what can be done, why, how, and sometimes you get something and you know immediately this is really cool. You know, yeah. Just like if it happens, it's really cool.
Yeah.
You know, there's people. It's like for people to get ideas from. Okay, we have our own ideas. That's like if you can tap into like a real core user, you know, if you, for me, it's like, okay, we're selling stuff. It's like, if you can find people who are like really core users of that, and that also think like that, who don't just accept, okay, this is what I got and this is my gear, but they're thinking like, oh, if this was like, if this buckle was a half an inch over, it would be so much better. And it's like, yeah, that's what I want to hear, you know, tell me.
Yeah. Well, let's bring Ian in here. Are you kind of in the idea innovation business a little bit, Ian? I mean, you're doing something kind of new, aren't you?
Well, you know, it's taking an old idea, and we're certainly trying to put some new spins on it. But a lot of what we're trying to bring to it is just a better level of quality, rather than reinventing the wheel. We're just trying to improve it, I guess you would say.
Yeah, but I think there's also a factor here, which is that one reason why this creating your own stuff is fun is you've got something to share and talk about when you're outdoors with your buddies, and that's what your product's all about too, right, Ian? I mean, it's like a beautiful ski that when you have it, you could sort of show it off and people would be really interested. It's sort of like when you share a craft brew with somebody and kind of talk about it.
Yeah, of course. That's a big part of the pleasure of it, you know. And as far as, you know, the innovative side of it, my partner Graham's got such a lifelong wealth of ski experience that he's been generating a lot of new designs, which are just, you know, kind of suited to the various different types of skiing that exist out there. And some of those kind of skis have been, how would you say, they just haven't really been developed that much yet because they're all going through this kind of ski resort market. And so, yeah, there's been a lot of new development in that way.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and you're mostly aiming at a pretty expert skier who's skiing the backcountry around Haines. I mean, that's sort of your niche a little bit.
Yeah, generally speaking, our skis appeal to a more experienced skier for sure. Yeah.
And most of them you build are being mounted with backcountry bindings and used on Big Mountain rather than at the resort, or do you know?
Well, you know, there's a bit of both, but the vast majority of them are for backcountry use, you know, and they're being mounted up generally with alpine touring bindings, and, you know, there's a few telemarkers out there as well. Mm-hmm. But we do get requests from people who want to ride, you know, the resorts and whatnot, and so we have, you know, skis that are kind of tailored to that and a little stiffer, a little bit more able on firm snow and icy conditions and whatnot.
Oh, that's
and,
so cool.
We're able to develop new designs as demand, you know, requires. And people come to us all the time with their personal, you know, preferences and what they want to see in a ski. And then we kind of interpret that and come up with a fresh design just for them.
And we got to go. But we'll let them know Fairweather Ski Works. We'll have you on our website so people can find you. Also, that was Ian Seward. He's in Haines. And Eric Parsons, Revelate Designs here in Anchorage. And also thanks to Dmitry Sodorov, who is a mountaineer and a sort of personal inventor. Thanks to all of you for being here. It was really fun. I really enjoyed the topic.
Yeah, thanks.
Next week, we're going in a totally different direction. We're talking about scuba diving with three divers here in the studio. Thanks for joining us today on Outdoor Explorer. Our producer is Monica Gokey. I'm your host, Charles Wolforth, and I'll see you outside.
Outdoor Explorer is a production of KSKA Public Radio in Anchorage, Alaska. Theme music is by Portugal, The Man. Views expressed are those of the participants and do not reflect the station or its underwriters. You can find Outdoor Explorer on Facebook and on iTunes. To see what's coming up on Outdoor Explorer and add your voice to the conversation, go to our website at alaskapublic.org.
Life Informed. This is Alaska Public Media.